narratives are very important. And by the way, when it comes to Bitcoin, Bitcoin is a technology. So as a technology, it depends on the adoption. And then the adoption depends on people being educated about it, right? So that's why it's important. And then when it comes to narratives, they are so crucial. Like, we define ourselves in narratives, and then the world itself, you can view it as a world of competing narratives. Now, the mainstream narrative about Bitcoin gets a lot of it wrong. And, you know, we are there to try to reverse it. And this is very important to us.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Super, super excited today to have our first guest, not only from Poland, but also from Ukraine originally, someone who has also lived in Poland for a period of time, who now is based in Brussels, in Belgium. So let me introduce our guest today. We will hop right in. We have Ludmila, I apologize about last names, Kozlowska. I hope that was okay.
Yes, the president. Absolutely okay.
Excellent. President of the Open Dialogue Foundation, a human rights foundation that we will talk more about over the course of this conversation. And then we have Kasia, who's the chief advocacy officer of the Open Dialogue Foundation. Kasia, I'm going to say her last name starts with an S. I'm going to allow her to pronounce it because I guarantee you I will butcher it and I don't want to do that. And Kasia is also the coordinator for the Bitcoin Film Fest, or a coordinator for the Bitcoin Film Fest. For some background, I met Kasia last year in December at the African Bitcoin Conference in Ghana. Instantly appreciated her energy. We'll talk about that more in just a minute. But I want to share a little bit about what the Open Dialogue Foundation is, what I understand of it, and then I will hand the mic over to these two ladies. So the Open Dialogue Foundation, sometimes abbreviated to ODF, was founded in Poland in 2009 by Ludmila. She was then a student in Poland. The organization serves to protect human rights, democracy, the rule of law in the post-Soviet area or in post-Soviet areas. I think originally the work that they did was predominantly in Kazakhstan, Russia, and Ukraine. But now I believe they also do some work in Moldova and even within Poland itself. So and the organization does everything from getting aid to Ukraine to supporting independent mothers in Poland to also combating financial exclusion with the help of the BTC coalition. So with that, welcome Kasia and Ludmila. Ludmila, I'll hand the mic over to you first. Please introduce yourself and fill in any gaps that I missed there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Frank. It's really a pleasure for us to talk to you, to talk to Bitcoiners and all your audience and everyone has privilege and actually listen and share with us our experience. We really, really grateful for it. So I'm Ukrainian, a human rights defender. Basically, foundation was initiated in Poland because it was my dream. I wanted to share experience how my rights, being an activist from local city of Sevastopol in Ukraine, being a participant of Orange Revolution, then Euromaidan, and many other activities, was supported by foreign organizations and just individuals from Europe. And also how it's important to have these circles of solidarity. We call it circles of solidarities, coalitions of solidarities for those who fight for democracy. And one of our main objects of foundation is to defend those who fight inside of their countries. For example, if you activist, entrepreneur, lawyer, family member of those who are politically persecuted, this is our target, those people we are going to support and bring their voices for international forums, to national parliaments of European Union, to US, to Canada, to UK, and many other platforms. And for these kind of activities, unfortunately, our organization was also under attack. There was more than 20 languages, a smear campaign organized by different authoritarian states. And this, of course, affects our banking, because you know how banking is operating. It's basically, you can be de-risked, so your bank account can be terminated, closed, just because your name or the name of your organization or people working with you associated with money laundering, extremist terrorism, and national security threats. So all of these bad wording were used against us in different obscure websites or controlled by authoritarian states websites, media outlets, for example, from Kazakhstan, from Moldova, from Poland during Jaroslav Kaczynski time. So all of this regime, they cooperated. And since 2018, our life became basically almost like nightmare because bank, I have to move, first of all, I have to say that I have to move from Poland to Belgium because Polish government announced me a threat to national security. The same was done also in Moldova. The same was done also in Kazakhstan. So all the three states, they started to cooperate to obtain my and my organization, our volunteers, our lawyers, our donors and our recipients of our banking data. Basically, they weaponized our banking data. They started to attack everyone around us. And imagine, it's just like nightmare. It's literally. And this is the moment when we realized that there was a period of time since 2013 till 2016. We were intensively defending refugees, political refugees, victims of abuse of Interpol, victims of abuse of extradition requests. All of them were also falsely accused in money laundering or extremist charges. And we understood that all this situation with banking, all this situation with abuse of Interpol, extradition, other interstate mechanism, it's all one big actually loophole under umbrella of anti-money laundering counter-terrorism regulation. And this is loophole is abused by regime. So this is a tool for them. It's literally not a tool, it's a weapon. How they can get your, mine, Kasia's, and everyone who is listening to this podcast, banking data without any remedies. And the only tool which became for us how to defend our rights, it became Bitcoin. While completely I was deprived right to have banking services, being in Belgium, I got all possible support. So national parliaments, international institutions, they were speaking on my defense. So I got protection also in Belgium. I have a residentship in Belgium. I won court. Imagine, vice chair of security services in Poland has to apologize that he smeared my organization, defamed my organization, me, my family members. He has to apologize. I mean, literally, he's now in detention facility because of violation and abuse of power, you know. And I have nothing to do with this decision of the court. Literally, I have nothing to do. I have no remedies. I have no legal procedure where I can go with this decision of the court, which defend my and my organization, everyone around me, saying that all this information in media and controlled by the government and fake website is not true. And bank will never react because no legal ground. So how are you going to survive in democratic country? We don't speak about authoritarian states because I live in Belgium. How are you going to survive in Belgium, in the heart of Europe, close to the European Parliament, just 15 minutes by walk? How are you going to survive without banking? Just tell me. Just with Bitcoin, this is only how you can do it.
I was going to say, I wish I had an answer other than Bitcoin. I have other questions about that because I know that I would imagine not everywhere in Belgium, especially people you have to pay your rent to or pay your bills to, accept Bitcoin. So that's another issue in and of itself.
Exactly.
I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah. So, it's super, super hard. Yes.
I'm sort of trying to process that. I did not know that. I did not know that information. The first thing that comes to mind is I deeply respect your commitment to what you're doing, given that that is what's been thrown at you. That's absolutely wild. I'm going to come back to that. If you don't mind, I just want to introduce,
sure, well,
let Kasia introduce herself as well. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you for being here. We are very happy to talk to you, Frank, and to share our stories. What I will add to this is that Open Dialogue is a human rights organization and an advocacy group, and we exist for 15 years almost now. And as Ludmila said, initially our portfolio was defending people who are politically persecuted or politically prosecuted. We are talking about, for example, political prisoners. We were also engaged in a lot of hands-on work, like with delivering humanitarian aid to Ukraine. But I would say that defending politically persecuted individuals was always at the core of our mission. And we did it both we defended people from authoritarian jurisdictions. Originally, it was the post-Soviet sphere countries like Kazakhstan, for example, some Central Asian countries, but also Ukraine, Moldova under Plahotniuk, and so on. But one of our mission is also to look at the mechanism of the so-called transnational repression. And I'm introducing it for a reason. Transnational repression is a way some authoritarian governments try to reach their opponents once they are already migrated, once they are already apparently safely landed, let's say, for example, in the Western countries. And I'm saying that because we defended people struggling with this persecution. And at some point, we became the target of it. And this is when the story of us being the so-called the risk or the bank in Brussels comes. So while conducting our human rights work, at some point, ODF and Ludmila personally and some of our associates as well were targeted by the same mechanism we're trying to defend other people from. And I would just say that when it comes to how does it all tie to Bitcoin, well, it ended up quite serendipitously because by the fact of being, again, debunked in the heart of Europe, in Brussels, Belgium, we discovered Bitcoin as one of this essential, if not in many contexts, the only instrument that we have as human rights defender to use to protect human rights. But then again, like this is all upside down, as you can tell. But this is not the end of this Kafka story, because we are a human rights group, but also an advocacy group. So our job for years was to gather information on human rights abuse and then deliver this unique data to policymakers, so they can act upon it. In this way, we, for example, freed, you know, hundreds of political prisoners. So now we go to decision makers. This is one of our main missions, together with our, Ludmila will tell you more about it, but we have this coalition, BTC, Building True Change Coalition. And through this mission, we are now informing decision makers about our story and how we can defend our rights with Bitcoin and just this magnificent decentralized instrument.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Amazing. I'm sort of processing this. I knew some of this, but I did not know all of this. So I'm quite amazed. So pardon me if I'm a little bit slow to react, but it's truly amazing what both of you are doing. Ludmila, I'm going to go back to you. So let's talk about, I guess, some of the nuance and the details that came with you being debanked, what that meant, and also maybe what that did to maybe broaden your understanding of some of the people that you maybe were helping. Sometimes we have a bit more empathy, sympathy, knowledge, ability to sort of help someone out when we've been through something ourselves. So how did you deal with this experience, and how did it now inform what it is you do?
So yeah, you're absolutely right that we understand better someone once we experience by ourselves. But the thing is, normally when you deprive the right to have financial services, this is something which is the most dramatic in your life. Because imagine you function without means for functioning. I mean, this is way of isolation of dictatorship, how they eliminate their dissidents, their opponents in their countries. So we need to remember that banks became one of the most important weapon. I'm not I use this word by purpose, weapon in regimes to destroy opposition activists and human rights defenders. Unfortunately, where we are right now, it's possible also to do so because of abuse of very important instruments, anti-money laundering, counter-terrorism regulations in democratic countries. So authoritarian regimes can do it easily. And my example, the result of what's happened with Open Dialogue Foundation, it's one of many, many of examples. So our role, as Akasha mentioned, we wanted to bring as much as possible well-documented, not just, you know, like something said and it's just like exists in the internet. No, we wanted to get testimonials, bring them all together, and do face-to-face meetings with regulators in many countries, whenever we also have. During our history, we over 13 years work with national parliaments, European Parliament, Council of Europe, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. So many, many interparliamentary assemblies and governments. And also we wanted to reach financial action task forces to say, guys, look at us. This is who are false positive or, you know, externalities, unintended consequences. Yeah. It's like this is a name and faces who, unfortunately, accused by authoritarian regimes with no ground, with threat to national security, money laundering, extremist terrorist activities. And we are many of us. We're silent because we don't have means to defend ourselves. And if we defend ourselves, for the moment, it's possible thanks to Bitcoin. But you're going to regulate Bitcoin just the same way as banking system. So you want to make it vulnerable. Like if we speak about crypto asset services providers, they're going to be operating in the same way as banking. That means that crypto asset services providers, all exchanges, all central exchanges, they will share immediately our data on the first request of authoritarian regime. And this is, I'm really want to everyone who is listening to this podcast, remember, self-custody, peer-to-peer transaction, so important to defend your rights because it's only your responsibility to know about it. Unfortunately, banks and crypto asset services providers, according to the current regulation of anti-money laundering counter-terrorism financing, they have no obligation to explain you why they share your data with someone's authoritarian requests state. And this is mean that you, me, Kasia, everyone, data is flowing. And this perception changed mind a lot of politicians with whom we met because they're also people, just like us. They also have relatives and they understood how vulnerable they can be. Their family members, how can vulnerable be just because of these kind of abuses. This is how we try to explain and educate everyone around in politicians and say, guys, we need to have Bitcoin as a payment and a crowdfunding mechanism. And this is in upcoming anti-money laundering regulation is going to be included. So crypto assets in upcoming anti-money laundering regulation, which affects 27 member states, it's written that it's payment and fundraising mechanism. So this is super important. There is also provision of protection of data flowing from banking or crypto asset services providers to third countries. We expose how third countries, national banks and financial institutions can be used to circumvent sanctions. There are a lot of discussion where, you know, that Bitcoin is used to circumvent sanctions,
right,
which is stupid. I'm sorry. The most stupid crime you can commit, try to do it in Bitcoin and it will stay forever there, just forever. And everyone would be able to check it. And why you should why you should, you know, kind of do these difficult movements when you have entire financial systems as a dictator in your hand? You can do whatever you want for billions, billions and billions. And no one is going to stop you because you are kind of independent state, no?
And we also know that major banks in the U.S. have helped authoritarians do this. They have helped money laundering schemes. They have J.P. Morgan is part of this. So the people who tend to critique Bitcoin the most are people who are actually involved in what you're talking about, enabling autocrats to move money through the traditional financial rails. So I appreciate you bringing that up. I think it's something that most people here, where I'm from New York City, I'm here in the States. They don't even think about this stuff. What you're talking about, they don't think about. But I also want to commend you. The reason you have to think about it is because you have put essentially your life on the line. And you know what it's like to be persecuted, to be prosecuted and persecuted as a result of that. Most people have not had that experience. A lot of people here, we like to sort of, many people, and I don't mean this in a way to call people out, but they talk a good game. You know, human rights, this and that. Very few people like yourself, I think, put themselves into it to the degree that you have. And what you're going to, I think, inevitably, the response you're inevitably going to get from people who love power and who love to silence people like you is the exact response that's come to you. I don't think many people understand how difficult that can be and what it's like in that sort of situation to have Bitcoin as a tool. And for context, I think it's the woman who, one of the coordinators for the African Bitcoin Conference, had said something very similar happen to her in Togo. She's a Togolese woman who has had issues with the authoritarian government there. Yeah, exactly. So this is something that for people listening, if you've never sort of, essentially open yourself up to being a target because you've spoken out against power, then you probably don't understand this stuff that well, but it's very important. And I've met with people from around the world who are experiencing this, like Ludmila. So thank you for sharing that. That's really, really important for people to understand. Kasia, I have a question.
If I may just add, it's even worse than you think, because we know financial institutions from Kazakhstan, Ministry of Foreign Affairs, like financial regulator of Kazakhstan, help Russia to lift sanctions in US. So they helped, there were sanctions, financial sanctions on the bank in Kazakhstan, Russian bank. So entire state institutions, financial regulators lobbied in US successfully, unfortunately, and they lifted these sanctions. So this is something what attention has to be done there, because, you know, we shouldn't allow to label Bitcoin as a only human rights tool we have right now, especially peer-to-peer transactions, as a kind of instrument for money laundering or something. No, we need to educate. We need to bring these exact cases. We need together come Bitcoiners, human rights defenders, to regulators and legislators and say, guys, here is hard arguments. Here is it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, I appreciate it. That's okay. Anytime you want to. Kasia, you said something to me that I've wanted to ask you follow up about since you said it to me. The first thing you said to me, you were like, you said something like politicians, and I'm saying this facetiously because I don't think you mean every single one. As Ludmila said, some politicians have been helpful, but you were like, I don't like politicians. Like, this is the first thing you said. And I was curious. So I think in the United States, people have this association with politicians and especially the political left is the only way to fix things. We have to sort of, especially being on the left or being a left-wing politician or something, these are the people that are helping. But I'm assuming that your experience is a little bit different than this. So I wanted you to expand a little bit on why that was one of the first things you shared with me when I met you.
You surprised me now, but I would just say, you know, I come from a very libertarian surrounding. So this is why the switch to the Bitcoin community. I was always involved in human rights and libertarianism that I understand as a fight for both personal freedom and financial freedom and for the free markets. I think that state, the work we do, for example, as a civil society, I think we are by far more effective in both detecting the needs and then delivering on those needs. One example would be even our ODF response to the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine. You know, like, I will just drop it as an example. And again, this also touches on the regulations and the financial system. So, for example, during the latest Russia invasion on Ukraine, the financial system, the conventional financial system, was basically paralyzed. It would take, the transfers got stuck for weeks. And for us, the most important thing was to deliver life-saving equipment to Ukraine, which we did. And we did in an extremely fast pace. In the matter of the first 24 hours, I'm not kidding, 24 hours, we delivered our first 100 bulletproof vests and helmets. And it was thanks to Bitcoin. This was done also because some crowdfunding platforms blocked us as well. So I'm not antagonistic to politicians. I think everyone has a role to play, but I'm a huge believer in the civil society, in the civil society sector and its effectiveness. Now, as a civil society sector, we are also there to inform the decision makers about the end results, about the consequences of the regulations they adopt. And referring back to what Ludmila said, I want to bring some hope here. So
yeah, please.
We were targeted, you know, by transnational repression and by the abuse of anti-money laundering and counter-financing of terrorism rules. But now, our BTC, Bitcoin Building True Change Coalition, it aims to share our story, ODF story, Ludmila's story, but also there are countless others who share this difficult story with decision makers to change it. And, you know, in the Bitcoin space, who doesn't really, who often is very skeptical, let's put it that way, who often is very skeptical with working with politicians. So what I would like to say to this community regarding this is that we actually can produce change. And this is what we are now doing at ODF. So initially, so the way our advocacy looks like, and I think it's very powerful, because we pilgrimage to politicians. And, you know, last 1.5 years, we had over 200 meetings with people from across the globe, the EU, the US Congress, Canadian Parliament, you name it, also international organization like Council of Europe and many more. And we go there as a group to show our experience and share real life stories. So we are also assisted by experts who we always invite to join us, but we share real human stories. And this is important, because talking about Bitcoin technical properties is just one thing, but we want to share how regulations can make people suffer, how we can answer it with Bitcoin, for example. And now, you know, as ODF, we have an experience of actually reforming monstrous big institutions that were always perceived as those closed institutions that no one has access to. Ludmila, when she started her first introduction today here, she said about she mentioned Interpol and the way she was put on the Interpol list for human rights activity. You know, it took us some years, but in the end, Interpol right now is less sensitive. Like, it's not that easy anymore to politically prosecute abuse. Yes. So this was possible. Reform of Interpol was possible, and we are doing the same right now with FATF. And this is something I think we are particularly proud of right now, because we just initiated last year a conversation with FATF, with Financial Action Task Force. For those that don't know, this is one of the main regulators in the financial sphere, and we will be by far more active in the coming year on this front.
Yeah, for it's amazing. The fact that you just used the phrase "we reformed Interpol" to some degree is for that alone, you deserve a round of applause. Absolutely, absolutely amazing work. And also for people who don't understand what FATF is, FATF is it's an international task force. It's an international financial task force. And it is, I actually do not know who oversees it, to be honest, but I think it's, I guess, a coalition
it's just seven
of countries.
Countries. If I may,
seven countries.
If I may,
okay.
I'll just explain. Yes. Yes, basically,
please.
It's let's say coalition of G7 countries which delegate their representative,
gotcha,
to create a financial regulation for entire world. So they use best practices. Their goal to fight against money laundering, of course, financing extremists, and all illegal money related activities and security related activities. But the problem is, it's about how the decision making process is happening in this organization. For the moment, we don't know how its president's elected, why, on these procedures. We don't know anything about candidates. The same was the issue with Interpol. So there was no even body at that time which can be appealed if something went wrong. So people were waiting for 6 years to be removed from the list of Interpol. Imagine. Nowadays, it takes 1 month up to 3 months maximum when you can be removed from Interpol if you prove that it's politically motivated. In case of Financial Action Task Force, this organization affects every single person in the world. Literally, everyone who has something to do with money, this person is affected. So for this reason, this body cannot be just a black box. It has to be cooperating and be open, actually, for decision-making process, for civil society during this process, regulatory process, but also with industry representatives. It cannot be like all banking industry has access to this, to each session, and no one from crypto asset services providers or those who are interested parties not have access. Just let's read in reports, okay, they are public, but you can do nothing, literally, if it's already public and it came as a recommendation for all national parliaments and governments to be implemented. This is the way how it works. And if you see that in its reports, everything around Bitcoin or peer-to-peer transactions, crowdfunding activities around Bitcoin and virtual assets is with negative wording or around NGOs, like it was before, but now thanks to their more open cooperation with NGOs, they changed this language. It was affecting us because all institutions, financial institutions, look at us as a risk clients because reports of financial action task forces define us as a risk institutions which can be abused easily by terrorists, money laundering, criminal activity groups. But come on, who is going to do it? Like we have entire police, we have prosecutor offices, we have everyone. So why banks, why financial institutions have to do their work? It's not fair because you don't have procedure of appeal. You don't have procedures how to defend your rights. That's why in case of police, you have the court where you can go to defend your rights. But in case of bank, where are you going? You have no way where to go to defend your rights. And this the problem we raised. But there is another aspect we have to discuss. It's about the mechanism how with good intention to defend the environment and energy security in European Union, there is crazy idea to ban proof of work as, you know, environmentally harmful or a threat to energy security in a global impactful way. This is something what makes me as human rights defender who is using Bitcoin transactions, peer-to-peer transactions, real Bitcoin, not ETF, you know, but real Bitcoin. Right. And we use it not for speculation. We don't speculate. We don't have capacity to speculate.
Yeah.
We just transact small transactions. Mm-hmm. This is what we're doing. We cannot use crypto asset services providers. That's why for us, it's crucial to defend proof of work, the mechanism which allows us for independence of Bitcoin as an instrument, as a payment instrument. It's the only our human rights mm-hmm. tool in authoritarian states. And not only authoritarian states, our case proves that we should have it also in democratic states.
Yes.
I will just...
Trying
to structureize it somehow, because I get the sense that, you know, we are throwing quite a bit on you because we the fronts are open.
Yeah.
We work on many fronts, let's say. We work on many fronts because this is the need, really. So to structureize it, you know, we see a lot of different attacks on Bitcoin. So on one hand, we see the abuse of anti-money laundering and counter-financing of terrorism regulations for transnational repression. So problem people get, you know, excluded from the financial systems, lose their financial rights, and again, there is no personal freedom without financial freedom. And on the other hand, right now, as Ludmila said, there is this attack once again launched on Bitcoin mining. We see also some other important moves we can talk about, including with FAT looking into fundraising and peer-to-peer transactions. And we can see that in various places, including, you know, communiques of G7, so most powerful, let's say, decision makers on this planet. And now, so we as ODF and together with our BTC coalition, we try to address it. And this, by the way, ties to what you said about politicians. So why do we think it's important to actually to fight on this front and to continue to educate regulators about Bitcoin being a humanitarian force and Bitcoin being a tool for human rights defenders? So, and again, addressing here the Bitcoin community, you know, everyone in Bitcoin space is searching for end users and everyone is in awe with Bitcoin being used for protecting human rights. So here we are human rights defenders using Bitcoin
and
for,
we need your support
to protect human rights
and to defend Bitcoin.
And we can ask and we cannot afford as human rights defenders, we cannot afford people decision makers calling the instrument we use in such hostile language.
Exactly.
For many reasons. I will just give you a few reasons. Like one reason is that, you know, whether you like it or not, we rely on politicians' help. Like how otherwise we would be able to release political prisoners? On the other hand, if we are interested in scaling in scaling Bitcoin for human rights, if we are interested in other NGOs and other activists embracing Bitcoin, then it will be very, very difficult to convince people to use it, to jump on this bandwagon, if the general narrative is so hostile. Like, this will lead to self-censoring and so on. And then when it comes to politicians themselves, you know, they are just human beings, oftentimes too... familiar with what Bitcoin is. You know, most of people on this planet are not familiar with what Bitcoin is. So there is also this beautiful educational dimension of our mission, which I think is always beneficial.
Yes.
And of course, there are just people whose lives at stake.
Cassia, please finish. Yeah. Please go.
So allow authoritarian regimes to basically call people who use peer-to-peer transaction between, donations or fundraising campaigns, just money launderers. Because if G7 countries, if financial action task forces will, adopt this language that peer-to-peer transactions possess financial threats or threat to financial stability or any kind of other negative wording, that will be immediately, and it's already unfortunately adopted by authoritarian states. And if you look into, for example, Kazakhstan, Turkey, Russia, they're going not after crypto asset services providers, they're going after those who actually doing peer-to-peer transactions. We need to defend even people who are transacting peer-to-peer in these authoritarian states. And for example, if there is positive narrative, if we defend positive narrative on Bitcoin peer-to-peer transaction, then Kasia, me, and many other human rights defenders can go and say, look, these activists were using peer-to-peer transactions of Bitcoin. And just because of this, this person was, for example, changing money. It's always risk, right? We don't have ideal mechanism where a person has no risk. It's risk. But it's anyways, it's instruments which give us the right to have transactions and crowdfunding. You don't have other instruments in these authoritarian states, right? So you have then ability to ask this politician to defend this person. Other words, if it's negative, you cannot ask to democratic the government, which itself doesn't want anything to do with Bitcoin, afterwards to say that, okay, I'm defending this person. So it's delicate. We understand that at the end of the day, in all this narrative, financial systems probably collapsing with this attitude, because you cannot survive in this way if authoritarian regimes easily abuse you in a massive way. But until this moment, we need to protect activists. We need to be able to use these instruments also legally. And we have all instruments to defend it. Kasia, absolutely right. We have all instruments to defend. We just need to do it in solidarity with Bitcoiners. Go, guys, with us on meetings. We're happy to have you prepared to the meetings and provide our arguments.
Kasia, it's perfect. And Kasia, let me pass it back to you if you did want to add something to that.
I think Ludmila put it perfectly. I think maybe just a general comment would be when it comes to, I think narratives are very important. And by the way, when it comes to Bitcoin is a technology. So as a technology, it depends on the adoption. And then the adoption depends on people being educated about it, right? So that's why it's important. And then when it comes to narratives, they are so crucial. Like, we define ourselves in narratives, and then the world itself, you can view it as a world of competing narratives. Now, the mainstream narrative about Bitcoin gets a lot of it wrong. And, we are there to try to reverse it. And this is very important to us.
We need miners to be on our side to give us testimonies. Testimonies, it means that you guys explain us how you work and why your instrument empower local societies, why you actually have to use only environment sustainable, sources of energy. This is what we need to bring, and especially because you want to ban Bitcoin proof of work globally. We need you from every piece, like whenever you exist, whenever you mine your Bitcoin, how you help society. We need to know these stories, put it in official language, understandable for regulators. We are here to help you. and meet with us whenever you in person can come. Or, for example, you can go with us on online meeting, like we now participate in on this podcast. This is what we need, and we happy to support every, even the most strongest instrument, which give us power, like Bitcoin, also need protection. And we can do it in solidarity.
I am just smiling, and I will just say to all of my fellow Bitcoiners joining Ludmila's appeal that especially if you think that, you know, Bitcoin will defend itself, or that politicians are badly informed and so on, especially if you think so, join us and try to and help us just inform them better so they can make better decisions. And we can just conduct our work, human rights work.
I thank you. And I think that that's a really important message for people, that one, nobody needs to be a martyr alone in this fight. Nobody needs to sort of be out there taking all this. It has to be an effort of solidarity, people working together to create a different narrative, to share this narrative in the world. It's one of the things I try to do here through the podcast. As I'm listening to you speak, especially Ludmila, you speak with this tremendous amount of authority. And I think that can only come from a lot of experience, and a lot of experience with very difficult situations. So
yes. We
could touch on Bitcoin if you want, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of space to talk about some of the victories you've experienced with Open Dialogue Foundation, just to bring a little bit of hope to the conversation, to have some people, you know, just hear what you think some of the biggest accomplishments of the organization have been. And this can include Bitcoin or not. And also what some of the most significant challenges are currently that you're facing or that you have faced over the history of the organization.
Mm-hmm. So one of the, I think the biggest our achievement, apart with what Kasia said about reform of principle, it's release of political prisoners. We were able for over these 13 years release hundreds of political prisoners from many countries. And I think this is the biggest gratification of what we can get from our work, because we see how these people can meet with their relatives, how these meetings, they change the reality and history of the countries, because it's activists, it's leaders of opinion, it's people who actually shaping new history. This is people who changing history in their countries. And they affect, of course, history of democratic countries, because when you meet politicians, human rights defenders, journalists with former political prisoner, they see the mean how this affect their life. And for me, it's the same. When I able to use Bitcoin and I see Bitcoiners, when I come to the audience speaking on Bitcoin conference and say, guys, you speak about the importance of Bitcoin to defend human rights. Here I am. I was in the heart of Europe and I survived thanks to your success and my success. This is our success because you created instrument which was able to oppose the most dangerous abuses from the side of authoritarian regime where no remedies exist. And my story repeated in many other cases. So now we help to defend many other families in Turkey, in Kazakhstan, in other Central Asian countries. And we show these examples. Guys, you have this hope. And here this is instrument. Learn how to use it in a secure way and let's protect it together. And also we succeed to educate for over 200 politicians, policymakers, which help us to include in several resolutions of a very important umbrella of organization, which unites 57 member states to reflect in relevant regulation the use of Bitcoin and stablecoins for humanitarian aid and for human rights. So now, if we work on this all together, we will include all of this positive narrative in regulations and legislation. And this is key moment. This is something what we achieved together and we need to complete it as a relevant regulation in our countries. 57 member states, including North America, including Europe, including Asia. This is amazing. This is something what we've done together with Obin Voss, with Jack Dorsey, Mike Brock, who support us, Ukrainian Blockchain Association, and many, many activists from all over the world who was with us during these years for this. And what else gave hope for us? We are capable not only change story of individuals, we change story of the countries. For example, in Moldova, nowadays is democratic government. No political prisoners, they released. And this is again a result of activity, both Open Dialogue Foundation, but also opposition at that time and civil society, entrepreneurs, because we defend broad scope of people. The same in Poland. First time, I have to say that person who initiated prosecution, former chief of security services in Poland, he organized prosecution of independent judges, prosecutors, LGBT rights, women rights, human rights activists, journalists, entrepreneurs. Like, people were arbitrarily sitting in the prison, you know, in European country. This is incredible. And this person used financial institutions just as a tool, as a prosecution, just like all dictators. So he's now under arrest. And it's again, it's possible because all people from Poland united their forces. They bring the changes during the election, and now step by step, they restore the rule of law in countries. So it's possible. It's all possible if we build these solidarity circles. It works in authoritarian states, it works in democratic states, and it work and it will work in case of defense of Bitcoin. So we can do it, but we need to do it jointly.
You are the boss, Ludmila. You are the boss.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm so honored to have you on here, listening to you share this. It's super important. And I think for everyone who, there's a sort of a challenge I want to put out there to anyone who's listening. Next time you throw around the word empowerment or some of these words that we use without thinking too much about, think about what Ludmila's done, think about what Kasia, what they do, and think about maybe a way you could take just one more step. So not just talk a good talk about it, but actually maybe join one of these solidarity circles or meetings that she's talking about. And I think that what it will do, it will have an effect on you to sort of, it will put you in touch with something that at first will be very challenging to process. I've sat in some of these sorts of scenarios or circles. They can be a bit overwhelming, if just because you're discussing how to confront very, very serious problems. Those problems can feel overwhelming. They feel less overwhelming when you do it as a group. But it's similar to what I've been saying to people. You know, it's what when people who go to like a Bitcoin conference, go outside of the conference, go see what the community is like. Again, that might be a little bit overwhelming if you're from maybe a very privileged country somewhere in the West or something, but go see it and deal with some of that discomfort. Because the other thing that I think you'll also find is you will find a sense of solidarity, of true empowerment, and it sort of animates you, right? It's something that really can sort of energize your spirit and make you feel that change in the world is possible. Everybody is very quick these days to talk about, these are tough times, look at this on the rise. But I think that what both of you are sharing today is a testament to the fact that the future is unwritten, that we can change things if we work together, that we don't need to create martyrs, but we need to create solidarity and teams of people who work to help facilitate the change that they want to see in the world. I'm beside myself. I have all these other questions lined up, but they all seem quite silly. Ludmila, if I could ask just one question specifically about Ukraine. I'm assuming you still have some family there. I just wanted to see if everyone you know there, if they're okay. If this is too personal, please don't get into it. And just sort of, I was just curious as to your take on what's going on there and to just give us an update as someone who's from the country. I don't really trust a lot of the news we get here in the States. So I just wanted to open the floor to you to share on that.
Sure. Situation for us, it's in Ukraine is super difficult. It's more difficult because, you know, media exists with waves. So there is a tsunami wave, which provide you a lot of information about Ukraine, and then the tsunami wave ending and ends information about the war in Ukraine. But war is continuing. And we're now in the most difficult phase because it's winter, it's minus 20, it's huge snows. There is no electricity, there is no water, because Russia during the entire summer and spring and autumn bombed the crucial infrastructure facilities. Energy facilities, water facilities, everything around. We see new equipment which Russia is able to produce, like drones, and send to Ukraine, while Ukraine has super limited capacity to produce whatever. or get support from democratic countries. We see the crisis of international institutions, so like UN and other international institutions, they cannot defend human rights. And Ukraine is one, and what's actually happening in Gaza, it's bright examples of why these institutions are not able to solve these problems. So we need new institutions, but this institution has to be led for responsible people. And this is how, again, we see that civil society has to control how this aid provided, how is aid distributed in these countries, and it's received by those who need it. And of course, about speed of the aid we receive in Ukraine. This is something what is the most crucial. As much as possible, we should have a weapon. I'm saying it as a human defender because you cannot, you know, resist if you don't have weapon. You cannot stop it by medical equipment. You can only work with already, like, you know, injured people or destroyed houses with like humanitarian aid. But you need, unfortunately, to have weapon to resist when someone is shooting you from missiles and drones. So this is a crucial moment. Of course, Russia is not going to stop on Ukraine. If Ukraine is going to be easy target, it will slowly but certainly also move forward to Moldova, maybe some Baltic countries. The aim of Russia is to destroy solidarity. So the same like we, for example, as human defenders, we try to build solidarity between, for example, now Bitcoiners and human defenders to educate regulators. Russia is doing the same with dictators. They build solidarity circles. We call them basically it's evil circles, right? With Venezuela, with Iran, with all dictators in African countries. And this is, if you look into the map, how many democratic countries and how many authoritarian states, you will understand how democracy is literally nowadays fragile. And if we don't have leadership who is able to defend, you know, fragile world, who can do it? Only us. We need to demand, we need to ask. Why and when this help going to be delivered to such country like Ukraine? And not only Ukraine, because the problem is Ukraine is one of the most brightest example. But human rights has to be universal. If organization like UN doesn't work, it's us as citizens. We have to take responsibility and care what's happening with human rights in other countries. You cannot just close your eyes and say it doesn't exist. It will come to our houses in democratic countries. It already comes with abuse of anti-money laundering regulation, and it will come with missiles. We don't want it. So we need to stop it at the beginning. And the situation is super crucial right now. Everyone is dependent on US, unfortunately, also on Germany, France. And how it's going? It's difficult. It's really difficult. You see, political debates is a target where Ukraine's role, unfortunately, is less and less listened for many reasons. Also for reason of corruption. It's there. And this is something what civil society is screaming right now. We have like at least two wars, once against Russian aggression and the second one against corruption. But we as civil society exist and we need support. If you support Ukraine, you support us as civil society, not those corrupt people or those who actually, you know, support Russian aggression. Because this is all about democracy. It's all about values. And these values has to be protected by real people, not just words.
I hope that resonated with people, because I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories that fly around about Ukraine and what's going on there. To be honest with you, I couldn't even totally recite exactly what they are. I just hear them and sort of turn my head to it. I think that's what the way you put it is obviously that's the perfect way to say it. I think we're trying to defend a free and open society. I guess my only question regarding it is, so the only argument I've ever heard that sort of makes sense about how long this war might prolong and whether or not it's the right thing to do, I personally do think it is let's say the situation were flipped and China or Russia decided to come to the aid of Canada or something like that, a country that was on the US's border, that Russia would inevitably see that as something that's antagonistic, the same way we would see that as something that's antagonistic if we were, you know, if that were to happen in Canada. What would you say to that argument, that essentially is, this isn't going to stop because Russia doesn't want to see free and open societies, you know, or America supporting free and open societies in former Soviet states or, you know, along its border?
I would say that be careful and look carefully what's happening right now next to US, because you, if you look what's happening in Venezuela, Venezuela is now trying its muscles, right? Saying that this territory is mine, this is territory not mine. You think it's possible for Venezuela to do so without Russia? Do you think that they don't, as dictators, don't analyze what's happening around? If Russia is able to occupy Crimea, occupy so much territory of actually Ukraine, and being able to circumvent sanctions and being able to grow its economy more than Germany, France altogether, so what? So who is going to stop Venezuela moving its muscles around US? And this is a sad example. So this, but it's also, I think, bright example. I mean, there is no military yet actions, but it all starts from talks. If you look into historical dimension, Putin start attack Ukraine with words. And words afterwards became a weapon. And nowadays it's missiles falling on the territory of Ukraine. This is all happening right now. Why we defend Bitcoin on the level of developing all of this harmful regulation, ban Bitcoin? Because we know that words which pronounce and promises given to European Central Bank define that proof of work is sustainable environmentally or not, that means for us end of possibility to use Bitcoin. And we don't want it to be happen and then to solve. So the same in case of ongoing fights around Venezuela or many other authoritarian states, which suddenly became so brave enough. Look what's happening in Africa. How all these dictatorships became so, you know, brave, because they see that Russia is able to operate and circumvent sanctions and do it with third countries like Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkey, Emirates, and they all left unpunished. Their financial system used to boost military capacity of Russia. And this war, unfortunately, against Ukraine and entire democratic world can last at least 10 years. This is financial capacity. We produce 7 reports. We have all data. It's all published information. This is also what, together with Kasia, we is doing on the same like we defended Bitcoin. We're exposing how Russia has capacity for at least 10 years because of support of third countries, financial institutions, state institutions to circumvent international sanctions. And this from one side destroys us. We pay huge bills here in Europe for heating, for electricity, for everything. Yep. And regimes just increasing their capacity to conduct war against all of us. This has to be stopped. This is why we also call, you know, for specific individual responsibility, accountability mechanism against those who control these financial institutions and help Russia to conduct war against Ukraine.
Beautifully put. Thank you. I sincerely appreciate that. I think that's really important. I think the Venezuela example is a great example. I used to live in Venezuela, so I've been following that, and it's a bit frightening for sure. I could ask like a billion follow-up questions right now. Unfortunately, I have to wrap this up soon to get back to work, but I have to also, I want to ask Kasia one question. You mentioned to me, you know, that being traveling around in Ghana after being at the conference was a really eye-opening experience for you. And I was curious if you could just expand on that a little bit. And I ask because I think when you do the sort of work you're doing, you're constantly sort of working with people from different parts of the world and having your eyes open to different experiences. And that can be quite sometimes overwhelming, sometimes beautiful. It could be a mix of both. So I was curious, being in Ghana was your first time in Africa. What was your takeaways from your visit there, especially post-conference, once you were actually just kind of traveling around Ghana?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for this question. It was really emotionally charging experience to me, and it gave me a lot of reflection. Like, I reflected a lot about what I tend to say oftentimes. So, for example, one of the things that I like to say meeting decision makers is to sort of juxtapose how your perspective is shaped depending on where you come from and where you are, right? So, like, when we talk to decision makers in the West about financial instruments, we are always trying to tell them, like, look, guys, you come from a very privileged background and you don't have to worry about, you know, not being able of using your bank accounts, whereas lots of people on this planet are not in such a comfortable position, and this is why we are here to defend them. And experiences like visiting Ghana makes it just by far more real, tangible. So I came back from Ghana being very much humbled and determined to do more. I think Africa in general is one of those places. This is exactly the continent that needs Bitcoin, with people having not that many opportunities, to put it very euphemistically. What will stay with me is that regardless of the very, very challenging circumstances and conditions people live there, I found people in Ghana very cheerful, very open, and ready to do something about their lives, to carry on with their lives. And so I came back with a feeling that we just need to keep a good fight.
That's beautiful, beautifully put. Before we wrap this up officially, I just want to open the floor to both of you if there are any last things you'd like to share. I have to almost apologize. I feel sort of so taken back by what you've shared that I kind of don't know what to say. So I just want to leave the microphone open to both of you. No, it's really beautiful. I know you're sort of laughing, but I'm truly, truly amazed at what you're doing. I had some idea of it, but this, you know, I didn't understand sort of the level of it. And even just the way that, like I said, you both speak about it. You know, it's, I think there's a phrase in English, you say like the truth hits differently. And when I hear both of you speak, it just feels like the truth. And I appreciate that. So please, any last things you'd like to share, including where they can find and support the Open Dialogue Foundation or any of the, any things that you're currently working. Well, let's just point them in the direction of the Open Dialogue Foundation. I'll leave it there.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. So guys, once again, we need your testimonies on mining, please. And also we need to defend, literally, we need to defend peer-to-peer transactions. We need to be able to use them legally, and we want and we know how to do it. So please listen to us and join our forces so we can do it together. Go with us on advocacy missions, face-to-face missions, podcasters, whatever, how you think you can support us, you need to join us and give us your testimony. So this is the first thing. Second, we opened fundraising campaign on Gaser. We also use BTC Pay on our website. We just click Open Dialogue Foundation. You see this B, Bitcoin, where you can donate whenever you want. So there is no existence of small donations. Every donation is count, and it's make us really more empowered to be able to work and dedicate both advocacy work, what we do in analysis of all tons of regulations we're reading with Kasia and many other of our part of team regularly, but also to be able to reach regulators, because we need to go there to, you know, to meet with them in person. Sometimes we get these funny questions. Can you show me Bitcoin, please? From members of the parliament. And this is an amazing moment which Kasia said that you actually show your wallet and say, you see, you don't need to carry cash to support activists. Don't risk your, you know, reputation. Don't risk security of activists. You just send Bitcoin, you know, peer to peer. That's it. So guys, we here. We happy and thankful for everyone who supported us last year, especially Obinvos. So you are our angel who is going with us literally 28 meetings sometimes per day. Like in Strasbourg, we have, this is absolute record, but this is what we're doing. And yes, huge thank you to him that he repeats his story meeting by meeting. He literally is doing it. Just like, that's why I'm saying he's absolute angel. But we need more angels. Guys, please join us.
Kasia?
What I will add to this is just I will just add to this a sense. Absolutely, we invite everyone to cooperate. This is the spirits we work with. We are just stronger cooperating together. But I would just add a sense of urgency to it. So now is the time. So we just entered 2024. We at the Open Dialogue Foundation and together with the BTC Coalition, we have huge plan for this year to conduct even more meetings. So on one hand, we have to counter some narratives. We have to provide testimonies as a counter narrative to the new regulations that are cooking up there. And we also have to follow up on the work we started 2 years ago or so, and the achievements we already have with Bitcoin being included in documents as a humanitarian force. But we cannot leave just there. We just have to continue and even raise up. So let's just work on this year dynamically and forcefully.
Yeah. Thank you both. It's going to take a while for me to process this. I'm actually looking forward to going back and listening again as I edit this. Truly remarkable. Kasia, I'm super happy that we ended up getting coffee together that morning and getting to meet each other, and that you could facilitate this and include Ludmila in the conversation. Ludmila, it's an absolute pleasure to meet you. I look forward to hopefully meeting you in person sooner than later. Please reach out to me if there's ever... if this platform grows and there's ever a message you want to send through it, the door, it's always open, even if it's, some sort of YouTube message or something that you'd like me to share, whatever it is, I'm happy to do that. To everyone listening, I will include ways that you can support and donate, all the links and all that stuff in the show notes. So if you're inspired by what these ladies have shared today, please share a little bit of money. And I'm going to say this to a lot of people that I know in the
Bitcoin,
States,
you please, have yet to not set up money, your... Bitcoin.
Yeah, there you go. That's right. I would actually argue that Bitcoin is money while all the fiat stuff is just currency. So, yeah.
Okay. Okay, deal.
But I will... Yeah. Thank you both. Truly, truly, truly honored to have you both here. Doing this, since I've started doing this, and I've said this many times on this podcast, it has given me such a tremendous amount of purpose, bringing voices like both of yours into the fold and just listening to you speak. It's such an incredible honor. So thank you so much for doing this, and I'll be in touch with both of you.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
My pleasure. All right, everybody, we will talk soon.